You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Many people's eyes glaze over at the mere mention of accounting and double-entry bookkeeping, but talk about big data, high-frequency trading, and subprime mortgages, and they can get very excited, even angry. Was it always so? Well, centuries ago, before computers, people still had information to track, projects to finance, and fortunes to make or lose, and there were financial wizards who accounted for such things, inventing techniques that we still use today. In his new book, The Reckoning, Financial Accountability and the Rise and Fall of Nations, USC professor Jacob Saul looks at the long history of accounting, financial accountability, and the growth of modern societies. It's published by Basic Books, and I'm very pleased that it has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Hi, it's a great pleasure.
And you also just had an op-ed in the New York Times today advocating wider understanding of basic accounting and double-entry bookkeeping. Have we totally lost touch with it if we're not bookkeepers?
Well, I mean, think about this. We had this massive economic crisis, and we never talked about accounting. We never talked about the accountants. We only saw them go in by the sort of dead of night into Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns and bring the boxes out. No one talked about their role.
Well, when a division of one of the major banks reports losses of billions of dollars and somebody is fired, we don't talk about it as an accounting thing. We talk more about it as a risk thing.
The accountants are always there. There are more than 750,000 accountants in the big four accounting firms, and I think hundreds of thousands of accountants in this country, many of them honest, decent, but they're invisible figures, and that was not always the case historically.
Are the ratings agencies like Standard & Poor's and Moody's doing accounting, or do they have a different task these days?
They have numerous tasks, but they were founded as auditing firms to manage the great railroads, which were completely unaccountable, and no one knew how to value them because they had so many moving parts. And so Moody, for example, came out with account sheets so that investors could get a sense of how these institutions worked. And his publicity for himself said that he was completely unattached to any interests. I think today that these firms have many different interests, and it's much more complex.
And they're much more dependent on the companies that they do the evaluations of for their financial well-being.
It's a huge problem, which I believe the companies in some cases struggle with, that they depend on these contracts, and yet if they give a bad audit, they can lose the deal.
There are some classic cases of criminals being tracked through auditing and financial analysis, like Al Capone, who was tried and imprisoned for tax evasion. Can a similar kind of analysis be applied to nations and their histories?
Absolutely. Well, first, I mean, you're mentioning Jake Greasy Thumb Guzik, who was Capone's, that's a great name, I love his name, who was Capone's accountant, and that's how they nailed Capone, was with his books, and for tax evasion. But what's really interesting is that this project that I started writing historically was about how nations were built, and at the time they were building countries and empires, accountants were on the scene, and they were often leaders, they were intellectuals, they were thinkers, they were people interested in art and culture, and the book began that way. But then when 2008 came, I said, my God, we don't talk about accountants, and we have all these accounting failures. And I said, not only do accountants build nations, they're also on the scene when we fail.
Former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury Juan Zarate was on our show last fall to discuss some of the financial tactics of the U.S. government in countering terrorist networks and other threats. And, of course, there are recent sanctions being applied to Russian power brokers. Do you think accounting is reassuming an importance that it had centuries ago, the forensic accounting?
I think it's very important. I don't think we talk about it. I was very happy to see that line that they're trying to audit Putin. That's what my book is about. Rulers often don't like to keep good accounts so that they cannot be audited. And in fact, historically, my book shows how Louis XIV created one of the most modern accounting systems. But when it started to show him how incompetent he was financially, he destroyed the entire system.
You begin the book with the story of Louis XIV. But the real story might be about the man behind him, Jean-Baptiste Colbert, whose name is similar to, I don't know whether he wanted to become a talk show host.
No.
What was he and what did he accomplish for Louis XIV?
He was trained as an accountant. And one of the reasons Louis XIV took him on is because France was the biggest and richest country in Europe and possibly the richest country in the world in the 17th century, the 1660s. And Louis XIV showed up as king and he was broke. And he acquired Colbert as his manager. And Colbert went into the account rooms and started doing better books and getting Louis XIV more income. And he became very important. It was he who built Versailles. And he did this through accounting.
You've compared him to Bill Gates. What's the parallel there?
Because he was an information manager. He actually used technology to build a sort of massive framework of knowledge. He actually built a national library with a National Academy of Sciences in it and kept the account books there. So this was this kind of high-tech thinking. He built this information bank.
When a monarch like Louis was fiscally irresponsible, who ended up bearing the cost? Was it the privileged, the nobles, the so-called 1%, or was it more likely what we now call the 99%?
It was the 97%. Many of them just died of starvation. Famine was the common cost of these policies. But what was interesting is that once Louis XIV really went bankrupt around his death, when France went bankrupt, they never really reformed, having one bankruptcy after the next. And it didn't end in a peaceful way. They had a big revolution, which was both violent but also very impressive.
But could monarchs just order the minting of money?
They could order the minting of money, but the problem was is they had to borrow money, often from the Swiss. And to do that, they had to give confidence or pay exorbitant interest rates. And that's what Louis XIV did.
Was there some understanding of economics, even though it didn't exist as a social science at the time?
Sure. In fact, I mean, Colbert is the father of mercantilism, which is this idea that industry has to be built through a partnership between the state and private artisans and industrialists. Some think it's discredited. The Chinese have shown that it might be a bit more complicated than that. But no, I mean, these guys were very sophisticated, but they were thinking in many cases about taxes and how to collect them.
But you also write that monarchs considered transparent accounting practices dangerous.
The first meeting that Louis XIV has as a king, he uses a memo from Colbert that says, our policy is going to be absolute secrecy, and anyone who breaks this will be considered a criminal and an enemy of the state.
My guest is Jacob Saul. His book, The Reckoning, Financial Accountability and the Rise and Fall of Nations, published by Basic Books. The first paper currency and movable type were developed in China. So why did the accounting revolution happen in Europe?
Well, it happens in Italy, we think around 1299, in Tuscany more precisely.
Is this after the zero and Arabic numbers were introduced into Europe?
Once the Arabic numbers come in the 1300s, essentially, or in the 1200s, they're able to do fractions. And without fractions, you can't do real accounting. Then they also had multi-partner firms that they used for shipping so that people would get together and they would all invest money to send a ship out to buy red currants, which were a source of sugar back then, to the Venetian islands and to Byzantium. And for those investments, five investors going into a boat, they needed a more complex accounting method. And essentially, double entry emerges. We don't know who exactly invented it. It's considered one of the great inventions. It's the only one we just have no clue who invented.
Well, you don't come right out and say that double entry bookkeeping is one of the great inventions of history, but do you see it as comparable to the invention of the steam engine or movable type?
We couldn't have either without them. Both the people that made movable type and the steam engine were expert in double entry. You couldn't calculate profit accurately at a complex level without it.
Well, what kind of impact did it have on the way people saw accounting? Was it similar to the Copernican Revolution?
I'm not sure it was as revolutionary as that because it happened in bits and fits and starts. It was a slow phenomenon.
So it wasn't an immediate paradigm shift as
No, but it
was. Thomas Kuhn doesn't want us to say anymore.
Well, but I believe it was a paradigm shift, because not only did it bring the idea of profit, that's something you could measure. Profit became a goal with double entry. That's the whole point, is that you put your credits and your debits in parallel lines, and they have to add up at the end. And if they add up well, you've had you have profit. But what it also did was it brought this idea of balance and this idea of a reckoning, that every night you closed your books and you made a reckoning with yourself. But it was also a religious act in the Renaissance, in the early Middle Ages. You also made that reckoning with God, that you had done well.
You write, without double entry accounting, neither modern capitalism nor the modern state could exist. Well, for those of us who are accounting impaired, maybe we should talk about what double entry bookkeeping is.
Well, right. It's this capacity to take large amounts of financial data and to calculate this data accurately. And for that, once again, you need this double system, because it checks itself. It's a check and a balance. If you sell a goat for 3 florins, you earn 3 florins, but you lose the goat. And each one goes in a different column. And at the end, they have to add up.
Well, how were accounts tracked before double entry?
We have rudimentary accounts and even complex single-entry accounts. They're more like checking accounts or stores accounts. You just know how much is in your account. This goes back to Mesopotamia. In fact, the first written language is actually accounting marks. And that has to do with the measurement of how much bread is in the stores of these Mesopotamian Assyrian cities.
Well, it must have been a lot more difficult when it was being done by whether it was calligraphy or Roman numerals or whatever, until Arabic numbers were introduced.
Well, Roman numerals were hilariously impossible. You couldn't account with them because they became very long. The word 800, the number 859 is almost a sentence. So it was very hard to do accurate accounting. Now, people did accounting. In fact, the word audit comes from audicio, from a medieval term in which the heads of monasteries would have all their factors come to them and read them the accounts. So accounting has existed since the dawn of time, but double entry accounting made it accurate, large scale, and profit oriented.
Well, if documents had to be handwritten, there was some room for deliberate mistakes, wasn't there?
Yes, double entry made it much, much harder to do because of those two columns. And they had ways of checking and verifying. But obviously, the great warning is that the better the accountant, the greater the fraud can be. And we all know how that turned out in 2008.
And also with people like Bernie Madoff.
And Ron, and the list goes on.
Did accounting become more important as people began to deal with goods that weren't perishable?
It became important when they had bigger and larger firms with different partners and they had more moving parts. The harder and bigger industry became, the more the need for this method arose.
My guest is Jacob Soll, S-O-L-L. He's a professor of history and accounting at the University of Southern California, the author of Publishing, The Prince, and The Information Master. And his latest book is The Reckoning, Financial Accountability and the Rise and Fall of Nations. It's from Basic Books. Stay with us for more. We are back with Jacob Soll, S-O-L-L, his latest book, The Reckoning, Financial Accountability and the Rise and Fall of Nations. Accounting has often been thought of, at least amongst my friends, as being rather boring. Have there been many books written about it, the history of accounting?
There's a big world of accounting history, which no one knows about, and there have been these kind of broken up books about the history of accounting. But think about this. There is no big book on the history of accounting until now, and there's no history of accountability. I find both of those facts chilling. And that's why I wrote this book.
Have the rise of big data and massive computing power changed the nature of accounting or what a scholar like you would do to study it?
It makes it much harder. And the smart kids who do accounting at accounting schools are big data people. They're math kids. For a historian, of the modern age of accounting, it does make it more difficult, and it becomes a history of technology.
Well, Michael Lewis was a guest on the show last week to discuss flash trading. Are techniques like the ones he discusses growing faster than the ability of accountants to track them?
Yes. Listen, we can criticize all the aspects of the financial industry if we want to. One thing I can tell you is one of the worries that accounting schools have is that they do have many constraints on them put in by federal legislation, which tie their hands. And as they are not as rich as the banks, they have much more trouble chasing the bankers. And the bankers also are attracting the bigger mathematics brains, keeping the accountants at a disadvantage. So there really is a cat and mouse situation here in which the the banking mouse is running away from the cat.
Well, thinking about transparency and Louis the 14th, do companies or governments today look on transparency in a similar way? President Obama championed openness during his first presidential campaign, but he's proven to be pretty secretive, and at least until the Snowden leaks, the NSA's budget was a total secret.
When he came into office, he made what I thought was the most remarkable speech about transparency. I started working on this project, and I said, wow, this is really important. He has not gone through with any of that. I'm very interested to know why. I mean, we can imagine why, but I think there are many reasons. It is very, very problematic about how little we know about the real workings of government, but also finances, especially during a war. We really don't know the cost of all these things because it's national security.
Well, I'm sure that if I became president, I said I'm going to change things. The people from the Pentagon, from the CIA, from the NSA, they'd all say to me, you're being totally unrealistic. And I'd either go against them or realize that I was just going to be causing too much trouble.
Or you might say, if a terrorist attack happens on my watch, my presidency's ruined. I'll do anything I think that's in my power to try and keep that from happening. I try and imagine the scenarios. I have been saddened that transparency has not been made more of an issue because it is absolutely fundamental for democracy and for healthy capitalism.
But do the issues of accounting and transparency make this an example of what economists call information asymmetry?
There's a lot of information asymmetry. There has been from the dawn of finance. There's more now than there has ever been because of high technology. One of the points I tried to make in the New York Times today is that due to this asymmetry, people have got to start learning the basics. It will not allow them to understand all these complex financial things, but they don't understand really almost anything, many of us. So we need to start, or this asymmetry is going to grow greater and greater.
I mentioned earlier that although China developed paper currency and movable type, Europe is where the accounting revolution happened. Historians and economists disagree strongly about why Europe diverged from the rest of the world economically. Do you think accounting was a key factor of the divergence? Is this even before the development of capitalism?
Early capitalism coincides with the invention of accounting. It is impossible to run firms like these Italians were doing without double entry. It allowed them to invent modern capitalism and set Europe rolling.
But weren't people in China, for example, or other parts of the world also having to contend with trade and doing business?
And they didn't create double entry. They almost got there. The Romans almost got there. The Greeks almost got there. The Arabs didn't get there. That's the one I really don't understand.
Considering the fact that they invented our number system.
Sociologists have looked into this and anthropologists to try and understand why the theories, or all these theoretical papers in accounting journals about the profit concept and the role of religion and all these cultural aspects that allowed the Italians to do this. But we don't really know in the end. I mean, that's speculation.
And then scholars like Douglas North point to the 17th century and England's glorious revolution as a crucial period in economic history, especially because of changes in property rights.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Well, and also England in the late 17th and early 18th century will become the center of accounting education. And they have more accountants than anyone else, which allows them to start the Industrial Revolution by 1720. It's very early to start building these machines using complex accounting.
People can be skeptical of new technologies. I remember back when I was told I was going to have to use email for all my correspondence in this company and how important the internet was, and I said, no thanks. So once double entry was introduced, how quickly was it adopted?
Well, that's another amazing story. First, the first printed manual, it takes for a general manual to come out, it takes about 200 years. That manual generally has been considered a success. I studied the history of the manual's reception. It wasn't successful at all. People didn't like it. There were countries like Spain, which had the Spanish Empire, that had only a few accountants that knew double entry, and they didn't have a manual for 100 years after the first printed manual. This is a technology which stops and starts and never really takes off until the Dutch take control, really, in the 1500s.
Well, did some people guard the technique in the way that firms today guard trade secrets?
You bet they did. Family companies held on to this. And when governments asked them for help, they often refused because it was their expertise that made them rich.
So were Italian accounting masters like Dottini and the Medici the Silicon Valley billionaires of the 14th and 15th centuries?
They were innovative. They were brilliant. I think they were actually in some ways much more sophisticated due to their embrace of art, philosophy, and culture. They truly changed the world. But they also helped sponsor public accounting schools across Italy, mostly in the north, but also in places like Naples. And that was a revolution.
Did economic growth in Europe bring a need to be able to plan for the future? Was that even possible when so much might depend on the next season's crops?
Well, people tried to plan for the future like they do now. In fact, the Medici we see early at the University of Pennsylvania's manuscript collection, we have some 1600 manuscripts from the 1600s showing that the Medicis were dealing in futures and that they went belly up doing it. So it doesn't matter how sophisticated you are.
And then the Dutch also were dealing in futures, which led to one of the great asset bubbles, the tulip mania. Was double entry bookkeeping a big thing in the Netherlands at that point? Because they were so involved in trade.
It was, but the tulip bubble did not really undermine the Dutch economy. It was very strong, and the Dutch had the capacity to reform again and again.
So but were they using double entry?
You bet. They were the world experts. Everyone from prostitutes to their leaders knew how to use double entry bookkeeping.
I don't want to get into the puns about prostitutes doing double entry. Jacob Saul, his book, The Reckoning, Financial Accountability and the Rise and Fall of Nations, published by Basic Books. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. And then you suggested earlier the Industrial Revolution just sped everything up.
The Industrial Revolution is really remarkable, and it happens in the Midlands in England. It happens 80 years before anywhere else, and that's where we see double entry accounting expanding and actually moving into new spheres. We get cost accounting. We get accounting for labor and time, which had never really existed. Josiah Wedgwood is the first to put a clock in the middle of his factory, which is both incredibly innovative, but also pretty terrifying because he starts reducing his workers to time. He also makes one of the most successful products and brands of all time, which is still with us today.
Mm-hmm. So it, to some degree, just when people started realizing they were hiring workers, double entry bookkeeping became a key factor in working things out for them.
At one point, Wedgwood stops making money. He can't understand why. He does these complex accounting calculations, and he figures out that he's not putting enough pottery in the ovens and that people are taking too long to do it. And he reforms his factory and starts making enormous amounts of money and beats the German pottery makers out.
Are there clear cases of nations rising or falling because of accounting?
I mean, I think the Dutch, who for really 200 years are the great economic power of Europe, they didn't just use accounting. They made it part of their culture. They made philosophies around accounting and balanced books. They made artworks. They wrote works of political philosophy. It was an accounting culture which in its best moments was very accountable and sometimes even transparent.
There's this joke. A businessman is interviewing a reporter, a social worker, and an accountant for a new job. He asks each one the same question. What is 2 and 2? The reporter says, 22. The social worker says, I don't know the answer, but I'm glad we had time to discuss this important question. And the businessman asks the accountant, how much is 22? The accountant gets up, closes the door, sits back down, leans across the desk and says in a low voice, how much do you want it to be?
Well, I think accountants would tell you that their job's incredibly tough, that valuing things is very hard. Many of the great accountants that I know, and I know some, they talk about the fact that their clients want hard numbers. They don't feel they can give them. In fact, they see themselves as really purveyors of doubt, but that's not what people want from them. And there is that disconnect between the accountant who knows how fudgeable and how liquid all these things are and the need for hard numbers. And we have to find that balance.
Well, are people – I'm assuming that there are CPAs think about double entry bookkeeping. But let's say some of the top investors on Wall Street, are they thinking in those terms or are they relying on other people and computer programs to do it for them?
I think that depends on the person. I think that people who are trained in traditional finance keep books and look at books. I think that they depend on armies of accountants to do it. But we know that the books are there. And again, there is that image, I think it was on Frontline, of the accountants descending by night to take the books out of Bear Stearns. Mm-hmm. Somebody made those books. And frankly, somebody had to know what was in them.
Well, given your study of accounting and economic history, do you have any concerns about current trends?
Yes, I'm very, very concerned.
You weren't a scholar of accounting. You were really a historian, and then you found yourself seeing accounting as a key factor in history?
I was studying the rise of states and political liberty, and I found a whole bunch of accountants doing amazing, innovative things. I then found accounting, which is supposed to be the linchpin of capitalism, as essentially it has a failure switch in it. We use it. It can work to great effect. And then it always collapses and fail, and people turn away from it like they did in the banking crisis.
Thomas Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century is getting enormous attention. Do you see any connections between the growing inequality that he has studied and trends in financial accountability?
I'm not an economist, and I can't completely judge his work. It's a very impressive book, but I do. I see it from a cultural standpoint where – as we have great inequality, we have less transparency and much less accountability. I think we're having a crisis of accountability. And I think people from all spheres of the political spectrum think that we're having it with banks, with government too, and even with individuals who can't manage their mortgages.
The incentive for Wall Street investors to understand the history and facts better is that there are billions of dollars to be made or billions of dollars at stake. But what do you think could be done to promote interest or at least awareness in the general population?
I'm trying to do it right now, right here with this book. It's kind of a hard case to make, right?
I'm not sure how it applies to me. If I balance my checkbook, am I doing double entry bookkeeping?
No, you're not. I mean, if you're doing double entry bookkeeping,
I thought that was a great accomplishment.
To balance your checkbook? Yeah, congratulations. You're one of the few people in America who's done it. No, I mean, I think what double entry does is it gives you this possibility to really understand your finances and how they work and to even make some predictions in the future.
Well, how closely is fear or ignorance of accounting tied to fear of math?
It's hugely tied to that and to the lack of practical mathematics. I have one of the things I espouse is that from the Renaissance into the 19th and early 20th century, everyone was supposed to learn this. This is home economics. If you owned a house or some pigs and you wanted to trade them or hold your property, it was better to know this. And that's what the educational curriculum of the Renaissance said.
And you mentioned in your conclusion that the great portrait artists are no longer doing paintings of accountants the way someone like Holbein might have. Do you think that might be because 600 years ago, the great accountants were also the great innovators, and that's no longer the case?
Well, that's part of it. I also think that accounting was held in much higher esteem. It was part of religion. Keeping your books was seen as a religious practice. You not only kept your books, you also kept moral accounts with your good and bad acts. You did both of these things before going to bed. And so we've really lost these cultural traditions, which were seen as very high and noble at a certain point.
Well, right now, computers are doing most of it, aren't they? And can't we trust them to be more accurate than humans?
Oh, that's a trick question. I mean, the humans are behind the computers. We can make them do what we want. I think it's dangerous to get away from that act of balancing your books yourself and making your own reckoning and facing what you've done. I find it very difficult to do myself.
And, of course, we know all those old stories about people keeping two sets of books.
Well, you have to do that in the old days, and people do it today, too. It's just
to hide money.
It's called taxes. I mean, the Medici did it. Modern companies do it. It was called the secret book, and everybody had one who was a businessman. But nonetheless, what's interesting is even in those secret books, they still make an accounting to God. And if they've made a profit, they wrote for God and profit in the book. And this goes on for centuries.
Well, isn't this to some degree also tied with early Catholic thinking that anybody who made a profit was committing a sin? And that lending out money for interest was a crime against God.
Right. Usury was, but it didn't stop them from doing it under another name.
If you made enough money, you hired Giotto to paint the chapel that you built to apologize to God for having made all that money.
That's right. A lot of the great art is either of or about accountants. However, in Holland and with Protestantism, that really does change. They start celebrating it while warning about the hubris of having too much trust in it, which is a very interesting balance. We don't think about that today.
That was Calvinism.
That was Dutch Calvinism. Mm-hmm. Nobody else did it. It's not all Protestantism. It's this specific brand.
Well, I don't know if we should end on that note. Do you have any?
That's Max.
You have any wonderful thing to tie all of this together?
Oh, I mean, I just think that we need to be aware of these things. And I think as we sit in the middle of these ongoing crises, we really need to think about this. And I do say, you know, my book is the first history of this that I find pretty scary. I think we need to talk more about all this if we're going to dig our way out.
And Jacob Saul's book is called The Reckoning, Financial Accountability and the Rise and Fall of Nations. Mr. Saul spells his name S-O-L-L. It is published by Basic Books. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much. A pleasure.